If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Okay, podcast time. You ready to go? Good. It's good that we're on the same page. Without any further ado, shall we get started? Episode 478, write it down in the book. Get your trigger finger ready. I will say star, smile strong, and I will say 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And of course, if you like what you hear, don't forget, you get out there and tell your friends, tell your family. Tell anyone that you know who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and by gosh, it should be theirs too. Spread that word. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Of course, if you like what you hear, you can always go to WGNRadio.com, hit the prompt for this podcast, and then you will go into a world of podcast nirvana. Elton Jim podcast nirvana, that is. Podcast after podcast after podcast. Scroll down, load more. Scroll down, load more. Scroll down, load more. It's good to know where we've been so you know where we're going. These shows are timeless, if I do say so myself. And we've been doing it for quite a long time, in fact. More than 9 years, going on the big 10th anniversary in 2026. And we're getting closer. We're at 478. Welcome to episode 478. And sometimes there's, as I've said many times, sadly, in today's world, anything that's happened longer than 15 minutes ago is considered ancient history and is not known by many people. And there's always been a generation gap. There was a generation gap in Socrates and Aristotle's day. So, you know, whatever. There's always been a generation gap. And the generation upcoming always poo-poos the generation that's either in charge or came before them, either just before them or even several decades or centuries before them. It's history. It's past news. They're only worried about worried about their time. And I mean, and believe me, I'm not adverse to this. I'm not separated from it. There's no doubt that I look on what happened in my lifetime as superior. That's just who we are. But I also have an appreciation for, and in sometimes even a great admiration for, things of the past. Not just 5 years ago, but 50 and 60 and 70 and 80 and 500 and several thousand years. I've been to the pyramids, okay? So I have an appreciation for the past, I think. And sadly, it seems, in today's world, we are just looking at our feet. We look at what's happening right now. And then, of course, as people get older, then the nostalgia starts to kick in. But right now, whoever's running the world, and especially in today's weird social media world, whoever's running the world doesn't really have much of an appreciation or care or desire to learn about what's happened before. And so sadly, now we're seeing some people that at one time had great impact on the world, and they've recently passed away, and it's a blip. And 30, 40 years ago, these people were shaping views that were shaping the direction of the United States or in sometimes the world. And then they got older and they lost their influence and they fell out of the public mind. And of course, like everyone, they wind up meeting their demise. And someone whose face was instantly recognizable, someone whose reputation was instantly known, someone whose views were instantly taken as truth and guided people, many figures. If they were from 50, 40, 50 years ago, they don't exist. This is not the point of my entire podcast, but just recently, a televangelist from the 80s, Jimmy Swaggart, passed away. Did you know that? Do you know who he is? People of a certain age certainly do. If you were living in the 80s, you certainly do. Jimmy Swaggart was one of these televangelists who was bringing in millions of dollars with a television ministry, thus the name televangelist, and whose deeply held conservative, fundamentalist, biblical views guided millions in this country. The so-called moral majority that established itself in the 80s. And it was a huge, huge force politically. Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party embraced this, and though that group of people is pretty much credited with Ronald Reagan winning and starting a Republican presidential dominance for more than 12 years between Reagan and George Bush, and really helping to restore the Republican Party at that time, which was badly bruised after Watergate in the 70s. And televangelism, like led by Jerry Falwell and Jim Baker, and as I said, Jimmy Swaggart, was a huge, huge force. These people were on television every day. They were quoted every day. They were known by face alone. Interestingly enough, Jimmy Swaggart was the cousin of rock and roll star Jerry Lee Lewis. And Jimmy Swaggart, as part of his television ministry, not only did he preach and cry how much he loved the Lord, and then when he sinned, I have sinned against you. And that's a classic video. You can go on YouTube and just look up Jimmy Swaggart's apology. Because, of course, while he was preaching the word of Jesus and the word of the Lord and taking a high moral standard, he was leading not only a double life, but probably a triple and a quadruple life of drugs and prostitutes and everything, all the excesses that, of course, on television, he was denouncing and conning many people out of many millions. And, of course, he was found out and banished. I'm not sure if he went to jail. He didn't really break any laws, but his reputation was tarnished, and he went into the dumpster of pop culture. But regardless, for a time, for many years, for a good decade, if not more, he was a huge, huge force, a real, legitimate, powerful force in this country, immediately recognizable to anyone, young and old, growing up in the 80s, living in the 80s. And now, 40 years later, he died without even a ripple or a blip. You may have remembered I talked about this a few years ago when O.J. Simpson died. In 1994, his trial was literally called, you know, his the ghastly murder of his wife and her friend, Ron Goldman, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, resulted in the trial, what was called the trial of the century. He was the most recognizable, notorious, and famous person on earth. No question. OJ, OJ, OJ. And when he died a few years ago, it was whatever. And it was like, wow. I've said this many times. If you're in the public eye, you don't want to outlive your peers. Because as your peers lose power, especially in the media, the new generation doesn't remember who you are and doesn't care who you are. And someone may say, oh, you know, mention this in an obituary, but it doesn't get any play. Believe me, I'm not bemoaning the death of Jimmy Swaggart. I'm not sad for it. But I do look at it, once again, from an objective view, whether I like the guy or not. He was despicable. But it was hilarious how in the pop culture world, he died and there was hardly any recognition of it. Whereas 40 years ago, the name Jimmy Swaggart held some real cachet. And it's just, it's another example of this. And I bring this up because of someone who also died in the last week or so. And to 99% of the world, no one will remember this name, except if you're a Cub fan or a sports fan. And once again, 40 years ago or so, more than 40 years ago, a former baseball manager and lifetime baseball guy of the name of Lee Elia just passed away. And he became famous not so much for his career as a baseball manager, which didn't last all that long, especially here in Chicago, about a year, but more for a infamous, expletively filled rant that he gave at the beginning of the 1983 season when the team was in April, beginning of this season, was off to a horrible start, like 5-14 or 5-15. And the area surrounding this is that in 1982, the Cubs management at the time, the ownership, was the Tribune Company. They had bought the team a few years before, and they were getting a pretty hard time from Cub fans because at that time the Tribune Company was one of the biggest and richest companies in the world. It was a media company, not just the newspaper, but it owned television stations, radio stations, and newspapers all around the world. The Tribune Company was one of the biggest. They were like Apple would be today. Maybe not quite, but they were in that echelon 40 years ago. They were that big of a company and that important of a company. And they bought the Cubs, and of course the Cubs were on their station that they owned, Channel 9, WGN-TV. But they were getting a lot of flack. The Cubs had a horrible 1970s, the whole decade, aside from the first couple of years after the 69 team, which had their famous flop. They still had a few good seasons, but by the middle and the end of the 70s, the Cubs were just a doormat. Horrible team. And so the Cubs made a bold move. The Tribune Company made a bold move. They hired the World Series manager of the Philadelphia Phillies, the 1980 World Series manager, Dallas Green, to become the general manager and basically whip this organization into shape. The Tribune was being criticized heavily by fans and media of not spending money and not doing anything to make the team any better. And the team, in fact, was in bad shape. Dallas Green came around and made some major trades and brought over some major players from his days in the Phillies. One of them, an unknown rookie named Ryne Sandberg, who played a pretty big role for the Cubs just a few years later. But at the time, nobody even knew who he was. Brought over some veterans like Larry Boa, brought over a guy named Keith Moreland, and really started to build up this team with a good mix of young players and players in the farm system to come up, like a Ryan Sandberg, as well as some veterans. Brought in Larry Boa, as I said, was a very well-known Philly shortstop, gutsy kind of player. And he also appointed someone who worked with him in Philadelphia as a coach, as the new manager, named Eli Elia, who nobody here in Chicago had a clue as to who he was. He wasn't well-known at all. He was kind of a baseball journeyman who'd been around coaching a lot of places, but Dallas Green knew him and worked with him in Philadelphia, and he picked him to be his first manager to get this team back into prominence. And as is with any kind of a rebuild, it takes a couple of years. Well, after the 1982 season didn't go that well, now there was higher expectations, and they started off pretty bad. The reason I'm saying all this is because Lee Elia died, and he gave this rant, which a late reporter now in Chicago, well-known guy named Les Grobstein, thankfully had a tape recorder. And ultimately, this tape-recorded rant, which became public, and it had every right to come public because Lee Elia was talking to the media, it basically lost him his job. The team was not performing well under Lee Elia's guidance. But this rant, as I said before, was filled with expletives. And it was really an interesting behind-the-scenes look at what goes on in a clubhouse and the frustrations of a losing team and a losing manager, especially, who had to have known that his job was on the line, even though he had an extended contract. But you could see that the team was not responding and not playing well. So the combination of bad results on the field and horrible public relations off the field with this rant, which became public, which not only disparaged the media, but most... it's crazy. Most importantly, disparaged Cub fans. I mean, he laid into the Cub fans for their lack of loyalty, for their lack of employment, for their lack of knowledge of the game, for their lack of for their basic existence. And that's why I think this is so interesting. When Lee Elia died, his obituary basically said Lee Elia passed away, former Cubs manager, didn't talk about his baseball career. He was a journeyman player. Got into coaching, worked with a lot of different organizations as an assistant coach and a hitting coach and all this stuff. He had his one shot as a manager. I don't know if he ever became a manager again. He may have gotten another job again, but didn't do anything with it again. But he was basically known for this 4 minute or so rant against Cub fans. Now, if anybody knows anything about the Cubs organization, the fans are the one thing that have kept this team going. Don't forget, this team went 108 years without a World Series and was still selling out. Okay? So you can't deny the Cub fan base's loyalty. However, this is what I'm talking, though, about history and the lack of knowledge and appreciation for it. Because at the heart of this rant, and I'm going to play a little of it for you, and it's beeped, so don't worry about it. I'm not going to play you the whole thing. But what you have to listen to is the essence of his comments. And basically, his comments are aimed at the fact that the Cub fans are not loyal overall, which a Cub fan today would think is blasphemous, and even back then they did. But what he's really aimed at was, don't forget, this is 1983. There's no day game, there's no night games at Wrigley Field yet. That doesn't happen until 1988. The Cubs are still playing all their games during the day. They were the only team left in the entire major league system that did not have lights. And they were sort of clinging to that like some nostalgic thing, although I think there are ulterior motives for that. But that's another story. But anyway, so if the team was doing bad, especially in April, you know, kids are still in school, well, things like that. What people don't seem to grasp, and you have to listen to what he's saying about the fans and the small amount of fans that show up to the game. And this is what my point is. Today, in 2025, and even for people who were born in the mid-80s, people that are in their late 30s or early 40s, and younger, they think that the entire Cub mystique and the entire Cub fan base and the entire Cub party atmosphere and the full house and the bleachers being full and the bars and the clubs and all the people and the neighborhood being the hip neighborhood. Everybody thinks that's the way Wrigleyville, which it wasn't even called Wrigleyville in 1983, but everyone who's, I would say, early 40s or younger thinks that what they see today has always been the reality of the Cubs, the Cub fan base, and Wrigley Field, and the whole vibe around Wrigley Field, and the neighborhood. And the truth of the matter is, it couldn't have been any different than it is today. In 1983, when Lee Elia gave this infamous rant, the Cubs were not selling out every game. There was nobody in the bleachers. In fact, there may be 5,000 or less than that at some of the games. Because once again, it's day baseball. So a lot of people couldn't take off of work all the time. And if the kids were still in school, who would go to games? It wasn't until late May or early June when people really started to go to Wrigley Field because the team was terrible. So there was no reason to go to the game, except if you were a real diehard baseball fan or a diehard Cub fan. And here's the other side. There was nothing in the neighborhood to draw you there at all. In fact, that neighborhood in the 70s and early 80s was kind of a dangerous neighborhood. Now, you look at it today and it's like Disneyland. It was completely different. There were no Sluggers bars and no Cubby Bears bars where everybody with a cool, there was no strip down, you know, Addison or Clark filled with cool hip restaurants and cool bars. There were corner bars that were shot, that were beer and shot places. There were little businesses. There were bungalows. There was a stadium plopped right in the middle of a neighborhood. And right around it was all the things that a small, quiet neighborhood would have. Mom and pop stores, corner bars that had old style, that had illuminated old style signs on them that were just dark and served shots and beers. They didn't serve pina coladas. They didn't have potato skins and nachos. People weren't walking around Clark and Addison with Cub jerseys on and taking selfies. People went to the game in the afternoon and left as soon as the game was over because there was nothing in the neighborhood to keep you there in terms of restaurants or bars or anything else. And as I said, it was kind of a sketchy neighborhood in terms of safety. So after the game was over, you wanted to get out of there. I know that's hard for you to believe, but it's true. I remember a time in the mid-80s where a friend of mine said, you want to go to his bar, this new bar that's just opening. Oh, sure. Where's that? He says, it's by Wrigley Field. It's called Sluggers. And I said, Wrigley Field? Why would you go to that area? No, there's this cool place called Sluggers. You can actually go to batting cage in there. Really? We went there. The Sluggers sign was the only kind of neon well-lit sign on that whole block. It stood out like a sore thumb because there was no restaurant row and party animal bar restaurant row there. I know that's hard to believe, but it's true. During the early summer months in the early 80s, the Cubs would draw 4,000 or 5,000 people. And then once school went back into session in late August, early September, then once again, 2,000 or 3,000 people there. That's it. No night games, just day games. Kids are back in school because the team was terrible. And had been terrible for a long time. Not since 1969, 1970, 1971 were they any good. But by the early 70s, they had lost their magic. And as I said, throughout the rest of the 70s and into the early 80s, they were the doormats of the league. And when you look at the Wrigley Field area today, you think, you can't even believe it. But those of us who were around go, boy, I tell you, it's a lot different. Now, the bleachers at Wrigley Field was the cheapest seat because it was the farthest away from the field to see the action, to see the pitcher and the batter. You can go to the bleacher for a couple of bucks. Now it's the highest, it's the farthest away from the action in terms of the pitcher and the batter, and it's the highest price ticket. Aside from, you know, these tickets and stuff behind the plate that go and have all those fancy schmancy lounges and things. But there was no bleacher world. In fact, where do you think that term came from? The bleacher bums. They were called the bleacher bums in the 60s and 70s because they were considered the people that didn't have jobs. They were the ones who could go to the Cub games during the day and sit in the cheapest seats. That's where the term bleacher bum comes from. I know you can't use the word bum anymore, but that's where the term came from. When you look now and you see all the things around that park, not only within the park, but surrounding the park, the bars, the hotel, the Gallagher Way now, the restaurants, the entire neighborhood with all these nicely renovated apartment buildings, unheard of in the early 80s. You could have bought one of those million, there was no such thing as a rooftop building to watch the Cub game from where they sold food. If you watch some early films from the 70s and early 80s of a Cub game, you will see these old ragged buildings across the street. They weren't rehabbed yet. They look old. They are old. And you will see people sitting outside their window, the people that were renting these apartments, sitting on their windowsill from inside watching the game. That was the extent of the rooftop community or the rooftop vibe. There wasn't such a thing. It was only when the team started to get good where in the 90s and so where people were like, you know, wait a minute. This is a cool view. We could rehab these buildings and a whole industry open. But in the 70s and 60s and even early 80s, that wasn't happening at all. Wrigley Field was not a tourist spot destination. It was not, there was no Wrigleyville. It didn't exist. There was no vibe. There was no cool or hip factor. There was this old ballpark that was seemed antiquated and falling apart, sitting in right in the middle of a neighborhood. It looked almost kind of crazy. Now, of course, as I said, it looks like a carnival. It's like Disneyland. And that's what was so interesting to me when I hadn't heard the Lee Elia rant in a long time. And as I listened to it, it wasn't just the frustration of a man that knew he was in a bad situation. It wasn't just a manager who was sticking up for his players. It was a snapshot in time. It was a historic moment. The way I looked at it was, he was part of the oral tradition. He was talking about a time that no longer exists, but that we really should know about and appreciate. Now, some people say, well, if the neighborhood was bad and it was boring and it was dangerous, there was no bars and Wrigley Field was kind of a dump and the team was bad. I mean, well, who wants to remember that? Who cares? Well, but that's where you have an appreciation to say, wow, look how times have changed. Look at how the sport has changed. Look at how the sports fan has changed. Look how the organization has changed. Look at how the ownership has changed. Look at how the commercialization has changed. Look at how our lifestyles have changed. All those ingredients were not of what we see today. We're not there just 40 years ago. And in a strange, odd way, amidst all the swear words, all the anger, all the expletives, amidst all that, Lee Elia is saying something very interesting and, as I said before, kind of historic. Here's just a small little piece. As I said, you'll hear the beeps, but listen to what he says about the fans who come to the game.
All right, they don't show because we're 5-14. And unfortunately, that's the criteria of them dumb 15 motherfucking percent that come out to date baseball. The other 85% are earning a living. I'll tell you, it'll take more than a 5-13 or a 5-14 to destroy the makeup of this club. I guarantee you that. There's some f***ing pros out there that want to f***ing play this game. But you're f***ing a f***ing stigma of the f***ing Dodgers and the Phillies and the Cardinals and all that cheap f***. All these mother f***ing editorials about Snay and f***ing the Philly-itis and all that f***. It's just sickening. It's unbelievable. It really is. It's a disheartening situation we're in right now.
But did you hear what he said? Those 15% that show up for day baseball, the other 85% are working, are employed. He's basically saying that the Cub fans, not only are they disloyal, but they're a bunch of lazy, unemployed people. They're the only ones who can come to the games. And they sit in the cheapest seats. Now, you need a small fortune to go to a Cub game. You've got lounges that cost several thousand dollars a year with the addition of tens of thousands, if not more. With the additions of season tickets, as I said, the entire bleacher section now is the hottest ticket on earth, more than $100 a ticket, especially on the secondary market. And as I said, the apartment buildings, the rooftops, and all the money that they generate, as well as all the signage now, the restaurants, the bars, the neighborhood, the hotel, the Gallagher Square, Gallagher Way, which is like a meeting place now for the neighborhood. The transformation of Wrigley Field and that neighborhood in the last 40 years is phenomenal. But the transformation of the team and its fan base and its attraction has been phenomenal. What's ironic is Lee Elia ultimately got fired several months after this rant, not surprisingly. Not only because of this rant, which was a PR disaster, of course, but then the team just continued to not perform. But the fact is that Dallas Green was building something. And Lee Elia was fired in the middle of the 1983 season. And he was replaced by a longtime journeyman manager named Charlie Fox. And then in 1984, Dallas Green hired a manager named Jim Frey, who had success in Kansas City and ironically was the manager against Dallas Green in the 1980 World Series, of whom Dallas Green beat to win the World Series in 1980 for the Phillies. The Phillies and the Royals played in the World Series. Dallas Green was the manager of the Phillies. Jim Frey was a manager of the Royals. Dallas Green and the Phillies beat Jim Frey and the Royals. However, just 4 years later, when Dallas Green was looking for a manager to lead his team, he picked Jim Frey. And so Jim Frey takes over this team that for the last three now, going into its fourth year, Dallas Green has been slowly building with free agent acquisitions, with trades, with draft picks. You heard the frustration in Lee Elia's voice there because he saw the kind of players that Dallas Green was bringing into the system. Maybe he couldn't motivate them. I don't know what the problem was, but he saw the moves that Dallas Green was making, and I think he believed that the Cubs had potential. They weren't showing it. But ironically, a year later, after Lee Elia was fired, the Cub team did something they hadn't done since 1945, which is win their division and go into the playoffs. Since 1945, they still hadn't won a World Series since 1908, but they hadn't even been in the playoffs since 1945. And this was 1984. This is almost 40 years. So clearly, those players and those building blocks were there. Now, there were some more players that were added in the 84 season, but a lot of the core players, Lee Elia had those players, but he didn't motivate them. Somehow, Jim Frey did, and an amazing thing happened. Between Harry Carey coming to the Cubs as a manager and the Cubs, basically the biggest move was during the season, they got a pitcher named Rick Sutcliffe who wound up, I think, going 16-1. He got them from Cleveland. He got him from Cleveland during the year, and he was on fire, and he won the Cy Young Award. But they had some hitters. Ryne Sandberg became a folk hero. Everything was hitting. Everything was just was coming together all at one time. Now, sadly, the Cubs should have gone to the World Series that year. In the playoffs, were much easier. There were no wild cards. It was very, very cut and dry. The Cubs won in first place. They had to play the first place team in the other division, in the other conference. It was San Diego. They won the first. It was only a best out of five series. You had to win three games. The Cubs won the first two at Wrigley Field. They just had to win one game out of three in San Diego. The whole city was abuzz, and they couldn't do it. And there was an infamous ground ball that went through the first baseman, Leon Durham's legs, which capped the whole thing. And it was another typical Cubs loss, just like what happened in what, 2003, with Moises Alou and the Bartman ball. Same thing. When people saw, well, the reason that every Cub fan went nuts when the Bartman thing happened in 2003 was because those people remember what happened in 84 when the ball went through Liam Durham's legs, and that's how the Cubs lost. The Cubs should have gone to the World Series and had a would have had a very good chance to beat the Detroit Tigers that year. They certainly would have put up a better game than the San Diego Padres did. The Cubs were better than the Padres. But it seemed like it was the Cub curse, the Billy Goat curse. Thankfully, we don't hear about that Billy Goat curse anymore. I'm so glad about that BS. But it was, to me, it was just another interesting thing about people that had an impact. This Lee Elia rant is legendary. As I said, the only reason that people even talked about him passing away on the news or in the newspaper was because of this rant. As I said, it went on for 4 minutes and it was filled with a lot more expletives and a lot more disparaging words about the Cub fans and things like that. But what I played you was kind of a crux, because basically it was a 4 minute rant, but he just kept repeating a lot of the same things over and over again, because you could just hear in his voice, as I hope you can hear, you know, he was just so mad and so frustrated about the whole situation. He felt like the Cub fans weren't supporting him. He felt that the media was attacking the players. And as I said, as a manager should, he was sticking up for his players, but they weren't performing, so you can't really blame the fans, and you can't really blame the media. And but how ironic that a year later, they wound up having, they were the toast of the town. And that was a team that had Jody Davis and Leon Durham and Ryne Sandberg and, as I said before, Rick Sutcliffe and so many of these players that have gone on and become, they were hugely popular. Then, of course, that's the season that made Harry Carey a folk hero as well, because he was broadcasting the games on Channel 9, which was a superstation that was on cable stations and went around the country. So the Cubs were almost a national team, even though they were a local team. But Channel 9 had such a reach that Cub games were broadcast around the country, and especially when they were winning like this. Well, Harry Carey was just was in his element. So it was, again, a perfect storm, and it was quite a difference from just a year before when they were the doormat of the league and they had a frustrated manager who lashed out at the fans who didn't show up. But a year later, somehow those seats got filled throughout the season. There wasn't just 15% of the bums and unemployed who came to go see the games, as the Elias said. It's amazing what winning will do. And that's what winning did not only to that organization in that 1 year, 84, but that was the start of the entire growth of the neighborhood around Wrigley Field. In 1984, because don't forget, even though the Cubs lost in 84, now there was great expectations for the team in the next couple of seasons. They still had that core group of people. So the hope was, okay, we came up a game short, but next year we'll get them. Now we're contenders. And the next couple of seasons, they had some major injuries to their pitchers, and the magic was gone. And by 1988, so was Dallas Green. He certainly was credited with turning the team around from 1980, I think 81 or 82, to 87 as the general manager and the president of the team. But by then it was clear the magic was gone. But the magic was just beginning surrounding the Cubs. There was still the mystique. There was still Harry Carey. And there were now, Wrigley Field was a cool place to go. And if there's a cool place to go, then what happens to the neighborhood around that cool place to go? Well, there's more bar owners and restaurant people that say, hey, there's a crowd there. And where are they going to go before or after the game? I mean, basically what's so funny is Wrigley Field, the whole neighborhood around Wrigley Field, or Wrigleyville as it's known, is akin to a tailgate at a football stadium parking lot. The only difference is that Wrigley Field is situated right in the middle of a neighborhood, so there's no parking lots like that. So the neighborhood is the tailgating parking lot. And rather than just being in a parking lot, it's in bars and restaurants. I would say probably a 2 or 3 mile radius. But the party atmosphere that you see now at Wrigley Field totally did not exist. The sold out crowds, the full bleachers, the as I said before, the suites and the club rooms now for season ticket holders did not exist. The huge concourse with all the different foods at Wrigley Field. No. When you went to Wrigley Field, you can get a hamburger, you can get a Smoky Link sausage or a hot dog and some ice cream and maybe a Pro's pizza. That was about it for a long time. Those were your choices. That was it. The guy came out with the hot dog with the big thing that he was strapped to his chest, gave you this bad steamed hot dog with a little packet of mustard. That was it. They had ice cream that was half melted all the time. There was no elaborate restaurants or elaborate menus with nachos and this and that and all these gourmet burgers and gourmet appetizers. No such thing. Wrigley Field was a gritty, dirty, rundown baseball stadium that was old and was looking its age, every bit of it, as was the neighborhood around it. And starting in 1984 with the success of that team, just a year after Lee left, started a whole renaissance for the team because it proved it could win when it had the right people in charge. And it also proved that it could draw people regardless of the day baseball. And of course, then the lights went in 1988, and now, you know, they're just like everyone else, and I think they're actually trying to get some more night games. There is a certain number that they're only allowed because of a deal with the neighborhood. But as I said, now, you know, that's the other thing. People don't even realize when the Cubs were going to put in lights, there were huge, huge protests by people that lived in the neighborhood. No night games. We don't want all this traffic and all this hubbub. There were the people that lived in Wrigleyville, and like I said before, it wasn't even known as Wrigleyville in the early in the 80s. They were there for the last 30 or 40 years. They were middle-aged or older people. As I said, this was not the hipster place to go or the hipster place to live. There was huge, huge protests against lights, and the Cubs had to negotiate with the citizen groups in order to get X amount of games. And that some of those are still in place. Like I said, I think the Cubs are trying to get some more home games at night now. They still have a limit. There was huge contention. There was a definite, conflict between the Cubs as they started to expand in the neighborhood and draw more people and want to do more with that stadium because they were kind of the cool hip thing. And some of the longtime residents, you don't understand, as I said. And I'm not trying to sound like I'm 100 years old, but if you go to Wrigley Field, on a regular basis, I don't care how old you are, but especially if you're in your 20s and 30s, or even your teens, you should know that it was not always like this. And it wasn't that long ago when it wasn't like this. And you say, well, what's the big deal, Jim? It's because you should have an appreciation for that. Wow. Look how times have changed. And if you're a Cub fan, times have changed for the better, especially this season. The Cubs are one of the best teams in baseball. And even though they're in first place now, it's going to go down to the wire, it seems like. Several teams. The Cubs division was historically bad for many years, but now it isn't. Between the Brewers and the Cardinals, the Cubs are still in first place, but they're battling. Hopefully they'll get in a while. Hopefully they'll win the division. But I mean, right now they've got some of the best players. They just had the All-Star game a few weeks ago, and the Cubs had great representation there. Pete Crow Armstrong is one of the best players in baseball right now. He's a phenom. The pitching, other players. I mean, the Cubs are one of the best teams right now. It's weird to hear even me say that. The Cubs are one of the best teams in baseball. But you have to hand it to them. They went out and they spent $40 million on one of the best managers in baseball. And a lot of people were complaining a couple of years ago, but not me. They fired, you know, Cubs mascot Dave Ross. Oh, because he was a part of the 2016, you know, World Series team. And so, oh, how could you fire Rossi? Because they wanted a real manager. And now you're seeing the fruits of that. And they've got some real players that go along with that. And now they're a real contender. Can they win the World Series this year? I don't know about that, but they are contenders. Anything can happen. But what a difference in just 40 years. And it was Lee Elia's death that made me appreciate where the Cubs are today. And that's my point. If you know history, you can appreciate the current times even more than you do. Because if you look back at what the Cubs organization was 40 years ago, in 1982, say 43 years ago, and the neighborhood, it was nothing. Nothing. One of the worst teams in the league. One of the worst decrepit stadiums in the league. In a dangerous neighborhood. With no bars and no restaurants and no hipsters. And now look at the field has been rehabbed. The place is packed. The neighborhood is jumping. And the team is one of the best in baseball. You can look at today and say, wow, isn't this cool? Yeah. And then you could appreciate it even more when you say, wow. Look where it was not that long ago. And that's the importance of history. And that is what sparked this new appreciation for me was the death of Lee Elia and his crazy rant. Because within that frustrated, angry rant, he had a snapshot. He gave us a snapshot of what Cub baseball and the Cub experience was in 1982. Empty seats, unloyal fan base, criticizing media in an old ballpark in a dead neighborhood. And 40 some years later, the Cubs are one of the best teams in baseball and one of the historic stadiums. And in one of the coolest, hippest, fun neighborhoods for not only baseball, but for lifestyle. Wow. What a difference. There's something to be said for that. So you know what? While many people didn't notice or fully appreciate the news on the passing of Lee Elia? I did. For a couple of minutes, I thought to myself, wow. When I listened to that rant, I said, wow, listen to what he's talking about, the Cubs, and how bad things were. And look at how cool things are today. So today it was more, this podcast was more about, was less about the Cubs. But I hope it was more of a history lesson, not only about the history of the Cubs in the last 40 years, but a history lesson as to how to and why we should appreciate history. And print it! And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 478. I'm Jim Tirano. I am here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of my mind to your ears.
For the f***ing nickel dime people to show up, the f***ers don't even work. That's why they're out of the game. They ought to go out and get a f***ing job and find out what it's like to go out and earn a f***ing living.